Not content with this destruction, the second team of F-117s struck at the northern abutments and smashed them as well. The only lives directly lost were those of the engineer and fireman of a northbound diesel locomotive pulling a trainload of ammunition for the army group across the Amur River, who were unable to stop their train before running over the edge. The same performance was repeated in Bayan, where five more bridges were dropped into the Wuryur Hay River. And in this dual stroke, which had lasted a mere 21 minutes, the supply line to the Chinese invasion force was sundered for all time to come. The eight aircraft left over, they'd been a reserve force in case some of the bombs should fail to destroy their targets, headed for the loop siding near the Amur used by tank cars. This was, oddly enough, not nearly as badly hit as the bridges, since the deep penetrating bombs went too far into the ground to create much of surface craters, though some train cars were upset, and one of them caught fire. All in all, it had been a routine mission for the F-117s. Attempts to engage them with the SAM batteries in the two cities failed because the aircraft never appeared on the search radar screens, and a missile launch was not even attempted. The bell went off again, and the ELF message printed up as EQT Spec Op, or Execute Special Operation in proper English. Tucson was now 9,000 yards behind Sierra 11, and 15 from Sierra 12. We're going to do one fish each. Firing order 2-1. Do we have a solution light? The captain asked. Valid solutions for both fish, the weapons officer replied. Ready tube 2. Tube 2 is ready in all respects. Tube flooded. Outer door is open, sir. Very well. Match generated bearings and... shoot! The handle was turned on the proper console. Tube 2 fired electrically, sir. Tucson shuddered through her length with the sudden explosion of compressed air that ejected the weapon into the seawater. Unit is running hot, straight, and normal, sir, sonar reported. Very well, ready Tube 1, the captain said next. Tube 1 is ready in all aspects. Tube is flooded, outer door is open, Weps announced again. Very well, match generated bearings and shoot! This command came as something of an exclamation. The captain figured he owed it to the crew, which was at battle stations, of course. Tube 1 fired electrically, sir, the petty officer announced after turning the handle again, with exactly the same physical effect on the ship. Unit 2 running hot, straight, and normal, sir, sonar said again. And with that, the captain took the five steps to the sonar room. Here we go, Captain, the leading sonarman said, pointing to the glass screen with a yellow grease pencil. The 9,000 yards distance to 406 translated to 4.5 nautical miles. The target was traveling at a depth of less than 100 feet, maybe transmitting to its base on the radio or something, and steaming along at a bare 5 knots, judging by the blade count. That worked out to a running time of just under 5 minutes for the first target, and then another 160 seconds or so to the second one. The second shot would probably get a little more complicated than the first. Even if they failed to hear the Mark 48 AdCap torpedo coming, a deaf man could not miss the sound of 800 pounds of torpex going off underwater 3 miles away. And he'd try to maneuver, or do something more than break out the worry beads and say a few Hail Mows, or whatever prayer these people said. The captain leaned back into the attack center. Reload AdCap into Tube 2 and a harpoon into Tube 1. Aye, Captain, the weapons officer acknowledged. Where's that frigate? He asked the lead sonarman. Here, sir, Ludaclass, an old clunker, steam-powered, bearing 216, tooling along at about 14 knots by blade count. Time on Unit 2, the skipper called. Minute 20 seconds to impact, sir. The captain looked at the display. If Sierra 11 had sonarmen on duty, they weren't paying much attention to the world around them. That would change shortly. Okay, go active in 30 seconds. Aye, aye. On the sonar display, the torpedo was dead on the tone line from 406. It seemed a shame to kill a submarine when you didn't even know its name. Going active on Unit 2, Weps called. There it is, sir, the sonarman said, pointing to a different part of the screen. The ultrasonic sonar lit up a new line, and 15 seconds later, "Sierra 11 just kicked the gas, sir. Look here, cavitation and blade count is going up, starting a turn to starboard." "Ain't gonna matter, sir," the sonarman knew from the display. "You couldn't outmaneuver a 48. "What about 12? "He's heard it too, Captain. Increasing speed and..." The sonarman flipped his headphones off. "Yow! That hurt!" He shook his head hard. "Unit impact on Sierra 11, sir." The captain picked up a spare set of headphones and plugged them in. The sea was still rumbling. The target's engine sounds had stopped almost at once. The visual display confirmed that, though the 60 hertz line showed her generators were still. No, they stopped too. He heard and saw the sound of blowing air. Whoever he was trying to blow ballast and head for the roof. But without engine power. No, not much of a chance of that, was there? Then he shifted his eyes to the visual track of Sierra 12. The fast attack had been a little more awake and was turning radically to port and really kicking on the power. His plant noise was way up, as was his blade count, and he was blowing ballast tanks, too. Why? "Time on Unit 1," the captain called. 30 seconds for original plot, probably a little longer now." Not much longer, the skipper thought. The ADCAP was motoring along on the sunny side of 60 knots this close to the surface. WEPS went active on it, and the fish was immediately in acquisition. A well-trained crew would have fired off a torpedo of their own, just to scare their attacker off, and maybe escape if the first fish missed. Not much of a play, but it cost you nothing to do it, and maybe got you the satisfaction of having company arrive in hell right after you knocked on the door. But they didn't even get a decoy off. They must have all been asleep. Certainly not very awake. Not very alert. Didn't they know there was a war going on? 25 seconds later, they found out the hard way, when another splotch appeared on the sonar display. Well, he thought, 2 for 2. That was pretty easy. He stepped back into the attack center and lifted a microphone. "Now hear this. This is the captain speaking. We just launched 2 fish on a pair of TRICOM submarines. We won't be seeing either one of them anymore. Well done to everybody. That is all." Then he looked over at his communications officer. "Prepare a dispatch to Sinkland. 406 destroyed at 2256 Zulu, along with escorting SSN. Now engaging frigate. Send that off when we get to antenna depth." "Yes, sir." "Tracking party, we have a frigate bearing 216. Let's get a track on him so we can harpoon his ass." "Aye, sir," said the lieutenant manning the tracking plot. It was approaching 6 in the evening in Washington, where everybody who was somebody was watching TV, but not the commercial kind. The Dark Star feeds were going up on encrypted satellite links and being distributed around Washington over dedicated military fiber-optic lines. One of those, of course, led to the White House Situation Room. "Holy God," Ryan said, "it's like some kind of fucking video game. How long have we had this capability?" "It's pretty new, Jack, and yeah," the Vice President agreed, "it is kind of obscene. But, well, it's just what the operators see. I mean, the times I splashed airplanes, I got to see it. Just I was in a G-suit with a Tomcat strapped to my back. Somehow this feels dirtier, man, like watching a guy and a gal go at it, and not in training films." "What?" "That's what you call porno flicks on the boats, Jack. Training films. But this is like peeking in a window on a guy's wedding night, and he doesn't know about it. Feels kind of dirty." "The people will like it," Arnie Van Dam predicted. "The average guy out there, especially kids, to them it'll be like a movie." "Maybe so, Arnie, but it's a snuff film. Real lives being snuffed out, and in large numbers. That division C.P. Diggs got with his Miller's rockets, I mean, Jesus Christ, it was like an act of an angry pagan god, like the meteor that got the dinosaurs. Like a murderer wasting a kid in a schoolyard," Robbie said, searching for just how dirty it felt to him. But it was business, not personal. for what little consolation that might be to the families of the departed. "Getting some radio traffic," Tolkunov told General Bondarenko. The intelligence officer had half a dozen electronic intelligence groups out, listening in on the frequencies used by the PLA. They usually spoke in coded phrases which were difficult to figure out, especially since the words changed on a day-to-day basis, along with identifying names for the units and personalities involved. But the security measures tended to fall by the wayside when an emergency happened, and senior officers wanted hard information in a hurry. In this case, Bondarenko had watched the take from Grace Kelly and felt little pity for the victims, wishing only that he'd been the one inflicting the casualties, because it was his country the Chinks had invaded. "The American artillery doctrine is impressive, isn't it?" Colonel Tolkunov observed. "They've always had good artillery. But so do we, as this Peng fellow will discover in a few hours," Sink Far East replied. "What do you think he'll do?"
"It depends on what he finds out," the G2 replied.
"The information that gets to him will probably be fairly confusing, and it will concern him, but less than his own mission." And that made sense, Gennady Yosifovich had to agree. Generals tended to think in terms of the missions assigned to them, leaving the missions of others to those others, trusting them to do the jobs assigned to them. It was the only way an army could function, really. Otherwise, you'd be so worried about what was happening around you that you'd never get your own work done, and the entire thing would quickly grind to a halt. It was called tunnel vision when it didn't work, and good teamwork when it did.
"What about the American deep strikes?"
"Those stealth aircraft are amazing. The Chinese rail system is completely disrupted. Our guests will soon be running short of fuel."
"Pity," Bondarenko observed.
The Americans were efficient warriors, and their doctrine of deep strike, which the Russian military had scarcely considered, could be damned effective if you brought it off, and if your enemy couldn't adapt to it. Whether the Chinese could adapt was something they'd have to see about.
"But they still have 16 mechanized divisions for us to deal with."
"That is so, Comrade General," Tolkunov agreed. "Falcon 3 to Falcon Leader. I see me a SAM track. It's a holiday," the pilot reported. "Hilltop 2 miles west of the Cloverleaf. Wait, there's a duck there, too."
"Anything else?" Falcon Lead asked.
This captain commanded the Apaches tasked to SAM suppression.
"Some light flak, mainly 2-5 Mike Mike, set up around the SAMs. Request permission to fire over."
"Stand by," Falcon Lead replied.
"Eagle Lead, this is Falcon Lead, over."
"Eagle Lead copies, Falcon," Boyle replied from his Black Hawk.
"We have SAM tracks in view. Permission to engage, over."
Boyle thought fast. His Apaches now had the tank logger in sight and surrounded on three sides. Okay, Falcon was approaching the hill overlooking the logger, codenamed Cloverleaf. Well, it was about time.
"Permission granted. Engage the SAMs. Out."
"Roger, engaging. Falcon 3, this is Lead. Take him out."
"Take your shot, Billy," the pilot told his gunner.
"Hellfire now!" The gunner in the front seat triggered off his first missile. The 7-inch-wide missile leaped off its launch rail with a flare of yellow light, and immediately tracked on the laser dot. Through his thermal viewer he saw a dismounted crewman looking that way, and he immediately pointed toward the helicopter. He was yelling to get someone's attention, and the race was between the inbound missile and human reaction time. The missile had to win. He got the attention of someone, maybe his sergeant or lieutenant, who then looked in the direction he was pointing. You could tell by the way he cocked his head that he didn't see anything at first, while the first one was jerking his arm like a fishing pole, and the second one saw it, but by that time there was nothing for him to do but throw himself to the ground, and even that was a waste of energy. The Hellfire hit the base of the launcher assembly and exploded, killing everything within a 10-meter circle.
"Tough luck, Joe."
Then the gunner switched over to the other one, the Holiday launcher. This crew had been alerted by the sound, and he could see them scurrying to light up their weapon.
They'd just about gotten to their places when the duck launcher blew up. Next came the flak. There were 6 gun mounts, equally divided between 25 and 35 millimeter twin gun sets, and those could be nasty. The Apache closed in. The gunner selected his own 20-millimeter cannon and walked it across every sight. The impacts looked like flashbulbs, and the guns were knocked over, some with exploding ammo boxes. Eagle lead, Falcon 3, this hilltop is cleaned off. We're circling to make sure. No coverage over the cloverleaf now. It's wide open. Roger that. And Boyle ordered his Apaches in. It was about as fair as putting a professional boxer into the ring against a 6-year-old. The Apaches circled the lagered tanks, just like Indians in the movies, around a circled wagon train. Except in this one, the settlers couldn't fire back. The Chinese tank crewmen were mainly sleeping outside, next to their mounts. Some crews were in their vehicles, standing guard after a fashion, and some dismounted crewmen were walking around on guard, holding Type 68 rifles. They'd been alerted somewhat by the explosions on the hilltop overlooking the lager. Some of the junior officers were shouting to get their men up and into their tanks, not knowing the threat, but thinking naturally enough that the safe place to be was behind armor, from which place they could shoot back to defend themselves. They could scarcely have been more wrong. The Apaches danced around the lager, sideslipping as the gunners triggered off their missiles. 3 of the PLA tanks used their thermal viewers and actually saw helicopters and shot at them. But the range of the tank guns was only half that of the Hellfires, and all of the rounds fell well short, as did the 6 handheld HN5 SAMs that were fired into the night. The Hellfires, however, did not, and in every case, only 2 of them missed. The huge warheads had the same effect on the steel tanks that a cherry bomb might have on a plastic model. Turrets flew into the air atop pillars of flame, then crashed back down, usually upside down on the vehicles to which they'd been attached. There'd been 86 tanks here, and that amounted to 3 missiles per helicopter, with a few lucky gunners getting a 4th shot. All in all, the destruction of this brigade took less than 3 minutes, leaving the colonel who'd been in command to stand at his command post with open-mouthed horror at the loss of the 300 soldiers he'd been training for over a year for this very moment. He even survived a strafing of his command section by a departing Apache, seeing the helicopter streak overhead so quickly that he didn't even have time to draw his service pistol. Eagle lead, Falcon lead. The cloverleaf is toast, and we are RTB over. Boyle could do little more than shake his head. Roger, Falcon. Well done, Captain. Roger, thank you, sir. Out. The Apaches formed up and headed northwest to their base to refuel and rearm for the next mission. Below he could see the 1st Brigade blown through the gap in Chinese lines, heading southeast into the Chinese logistics area. Task Force 77 had been holding station east of the Formosa Strait until receiving orders to race west. The various air bosses had word that one of their submarines had eliminated a Chinese bomber and fast-attack submarine, which was fine with them, and probably just peachy for the task force commander. Now it was their job to go after the People's Liberation Army Navy, which, they all agreed, was a hell of a name for a maritime armed force. The 1st aircraft to go off, behind the F-14D's Flying Barrier Combat Air Patrol, or BARCAP, for the task force, were the E-2C Hawkeye radar aircraft, the Navy's 2-engine prop-driven mini AWACS. These were tasked to finding targets for the shooters, mainly FA-18 Hornets. This was to be a complex operation. The task force had 3 SSNs assigned to sanitize the area of TRICOM submarines. The task force commander seemed especially concerned with the possibility of a Chinese diesel-powered SSK punching a hole in one of his ships, but that was not an immediate concern for the airmen, unless they could find one tied alongside the pier. The only real problem was target identification. There was ample commercial shipping in the area, and they had orders to leave that entirely alone, even ships flying the PRC flag. Anything with a SAM radar would be engaged beyond visual range, Otherwise, a pilot had to have eyeballs on the target before loosing a weapon. Of weapons, they had plenty, and ships were fragile targets as far as missiles and 1,000-pound bombs were concerned. The overall target was the PLAN South Sea Fleet, based at Guangzhou, better known to Westerners as Canton. The naval base there was well sited for attack, though it was defended by surface-to-air missile batteries and some flak. The F-14s on the lead were guided to aerial targets by the Hawkeyes. Again, since there was commercial air traffic in the sky, the fighter pilots had to close to visual range for a positive ID of their targets. This could be dangerous, but there was no avoiding it. What the Navy pilots didn't know was that the Chinese knew the electronic signature of the APD-138 radar on the E-2Cs, and therefore they also knew that something was coming. Fully 100 Chinese fighters scrambled into the air and set up their own combat air patrol over their east coast. The Hawkeyes spotted that and radioed a warning to the advancing fighters, setting the stage for a massive air engagement in the pre-dawn darkness. There was no elegant way to go about it. Two squadrons of Tomcats, 24 in all, led the strike force. Each carried four AIM-54C Phoenix missiles, plus four AIM-9X Sidewinders. The Phoenixes were old, nearly 15 years old for some of them, and in some cases the solid-fuel motor bodies were developing cracks that would soon become apparent. They had a theoretical range of over 100 miles, however, and that made them useful things to hang on one's airframe. The Hawkeye crews had orders to make careful determination of what was a duck and what was a goose, but it was agreed quickly that two or more aircraft flying in close formation were not airbuses full of civilian passengers, and the Tomcats were authorized to shoot a full 100 miles off the Chinese mainland. The first salvo was composed of 48. Of these, 6 self-destructed within 500 yards of their launching aircraft, to the displeased surprise of the pilots involved. The remaining 42 streaked upward in a ballistic path to a height of over 100,000 feet, before tipping over at Mach 5 speed and switching on their millimeter-band Doppler homing radars. By the end of their flight, their motors were burned out, and they did not leave the smoke trail that pilots look for. Thus, though the Chinese pilots knew that they'd been illuminated, they couldn't see the danger coming, and therefore could not see anything to evade. The 42 Phoenixes started going off in their formations, and the only survivors were those who broke into radical turns when they saw the first warheads go off. All in all, the 48 launches resulted in 32 kills. The surviving Chinese pilots were shaken, but also enraged. As one man, they turned east and lit up their search radars, looking for targets for their own air-to-air missiles. These they found, but beyond range of their weapons. The senior officer surviving the initial attack ordered them to go to afterburner and streak east. And at a range of 60 miles, they fired off their PL-10 radar-guided air-to-air missiles. These were a copy of the Italian Aspide, in turn a copy of the old American AIM-7E Sparrow. To track a target, they required that the launching aircraft keep itself and its radar pointed at the target. In this case, the Americans were heading in as well, with their own radars emitting, and what happened was a great game of chicken, with the fighter pilots on either side unwilling to turn and run. And besides, they all figured that to do so merely guaranteed one's death. And so the race was between airplanes and missiles. But the PL-10 had a speed of Mach 4 against the Phoenix's Mach 5. Back on the Hawkeyes, the crewmen kept track of the engagement. Both the aircraft and the streaking missiles were visible on the scopes, and there was a collective holding of breath for this one. The Phoenixes hit first, killing 31 more PLA-AF fighters, and also turning off their radars rather abruptly. That made some of their missiles go dumb, but not all, and the 6 Chinese fighters that survived the second Phoenix barrage found themselves illuminating targets for a total of 39 PL-10s, which angled for only 4 Tomcats. The American pilots affected by this saw them coming, and the feeling wasn't particularly pleasant. Each went to afterburner and dove for the deck, losing every bit of chaff and flares he had in his protection pods, plus turning the jamming pods up to max power. One got clean away. Another lost most of them in the chaff, where the Chinese missiles exploded like fireworks in his wake. But one of the F-14s had 19 missiles chasing him alone, and there was no avoiding them all. The third missile got close enough to trigger its warhead, and then 9 more, and the Tomcat was reduced to chaff itself, along with its 2-man crew. That left one Navy fighter whose radar intercept officer ejected safely, though the pilot did not. The remaining Tomcats continued to bore in. They were out of Phoenix missiles now, and closed to continue the engagement with Sidewinders. Losing comrades did nothing more than anger them for the moment, and this time it was the Chinese who turned back and headed for their coast, chased by a cloud of heat-seeking missiles. This bar fight had the effect of clearing the way for the strike force. The PLAN base had 12 piers with ships alongside, and the United States Navy went after its Chinese counterpart. As usually happened, on the principle that in war people invariably killed those most like themselves before going after the different ones. The first to draw the wrath of the Hornets were the submarines. They were mainly old Romeo-class diesel boats, long past whatever prime they'd once had. They were mainly rafted in pairs, and the Hornet drivers struck at them with skippers and slams. The former was a 1,000-pound bomb with a rudimentary guidance package attached, plus a rocket motor taken off obsolete missiles, and they proved adequate to the task. The pilots tried to guide them between the rafted submarines, so as to kill two with a single weapon, and that worked in 3 out of 5 attempts. SLAM was a land attack version of the Harpoon anti-ship missile, and these were directed at the port and maintenance facilities without which a naval base is just a cluttered beach. The damage done looked impressive on the videotapes. Other aircraft tasked to a mission called Iron Hand sought out Chinese missile and flak batteries, and engaged those at safe distance with HARM anti-radiation missiles, which sought out and destroyed acquisition and illumination radars with high reliability. All in all, the first U.S. Navy attack on the mainland of East Asia since Vietnam went off well, eliminating 12 PRC warships and laying waste to one of its principal naval bases. Other bases were attacked with Tomahawk cruise missiles launched mainly from surface ships. Every PLAN base over a swath of 500 miles of coast took one form of fire or another, and the ship count was jacked up to 16, all in a period of a little over an hour. The American tactical aircraft returned to their carriers, having spilled the blood of their enemies, though also having lost some of their own. Chapter 58. Political Fallout. It was a difficult night for Marshal Luo Kong, the defense minister for the People's Republic of China. He'd gone to bed about 11 the previous night, concerned with the ongoing operations of his military forces, but pleased that they seemed to be going well. And then, just after he'd closed his eyes, the phone rang. His official car came at once to convey him to his office, but he didn't enter it. Instead, he went to the Defense Ministry's communication center, where he found a number of senior and mid-level officers going over fragmentary information and trying to make sense of it. Minister Luo's presence didn't help them, but just added stress to the existing chaos. Nothing seemed clear, except that they could identify holes in their information. The 65th Army had seemingly dropped off the face of the earth. Its commanding general had been visiting one of his divisions, along with his staff, and hadn't been heard from since 0200 or so. Nor had the division's commanding general. In fact, nothing at all was known about what was happening up there. To fix that, Marshal Luo ordered a helicopter to fly up from the depot at Sunwu. Then came reports from Harbin and Bayan of air raids that had damaged the railroads. A colonel of engineers was dispatched to look into that. But just when he thought he'd gotten a handle on the difficulties in Siberia, then came reports of an air attack on the fleet base at Guangzhou, and then the lesser naval bases at Haikuo, Shantou, and Xiachuandao. In each case, the headquarters facilities seemed hard hit, since there was no response from the local commanders. Most disturbing of all was the report of huge losses to the fighter regiments in the area, reports of American naval aircraft making the attacks. Then, finally, worst of all, a pair of automatic signals, the distress boys from his country's only nuclear-powered missile submarine and the Hunter submarine detailed to protect her, the Hai Long, were both radiating their automated messages. It struck the Marshal as unlikely to the point of impossibility that so many things could have happened at once. And yet there was more. Border radar emplacements were off the air and could not be raised on radio or telephone. Then came another phone call from Siberia. One of the divisions on the left shoulder of the breakthrough, the one the commanding general of 65th Type B Group Army had been visiting a few hours before, reported. That is, a junior communications officer said, a subunit of the division reported, that unknown armored forces had lanced through its western defenses going east and disappeared. "How the hell does an enemy attack successfully and disappear?" the marshal had demanded, in a voice to make the young captain wilt. "Who reported this?" "He identified himself as a major in the 3rd Battalion, 745th Guards Infantry Regiment, Comrade Marshal," was the trembling reply. "The radio connection was scratchy, or so it was reported to us." "And who made the report?" "A Colonel Zhao, senior communications officer in the intelligence staff of 71st Type C Group Army north of Bayan. They are detailed to border security in the breakthrough sector," the captain explained.
"I know that,"
Luo bellowed, taking out his rage on the nearest target of opportunity. "Comrade Marshal," said a new voice. It was Major General Wei Daoming, one of Luo's senior aides, just called in from his home after one more of a long string of long days, and showing the strain, but trying to smooth the troubled waters even so. "You should let me and my staff assemble this information in such a way that we can present it to you in an orderly manner." "Yes, Wei, I suppose so." Luo knew that this was good advice, and Wei was a career intelligence officer, accustomed to organizing information for his superiors. "Quick as you can." "Of course, Comrade Minister," Wei said, to remind Luo that he was a political figure now rather than the military officer he'd grown up as. Luo went to the VIP sitting room, where green tea was waiting. He reached into the pocket of his uniform tunic and pulled out some cigarettes, strong, unfiltered ones to help him wake up. They made him cough, but that was all right. By the third cup of tea, Wei returned with a pad of paper scribbled with notes. "So, what is happening?" "The picture is confused, but I will tell you what I know and what I think," Wei began. "We know that General Qi of 65th Army is missing, along with his staff. They were visiting 191st Infantry Division, just north and west of our initial breakthrough. The 191st is completely off the air as well. So is the 615th Independent Tank Brigade, part of 65th Army. Confused reports talk of an air attack on the tank brigade, but nothing precise is known. The 735th Guards Infantry Regiment of the 191st Division is also off the air, cause unknown. You ordered a helicopter out of Sun Wu to take a look and report back. The helicopter will get off at dawn. Well and good. Next, there are additional reports from that sector, none of which make sense or help form any picture of what is happening. So I have ordered the intelligence staff of the 71st Army to send a reconnaissance team across the river and ascertain what's happening there and report back. That will take about 3 hours. The good news is that General Peng Shiwang remains in command of 34th Shock Army and will be at the gold mine before midday. Our armored spearhead is deep within enemy territory. I expect the men are waking up right now and will be moving within the hour to continue their attack. Now, this news from the Navy people is confusing, but it's not really a matter of consequence. I've directed the commander of South Sea Fleet to take personal charge of the situation and report back. So say about 3 hours for that. So, Comrade Minister, we will have decent information shortly, and then we can start addressing the situation. Until then, General Peng will soon resume his offensive, and by evening, our country will be much richer," Wei concluded. He knew how to keep his minister happy. His reward for this was a grunt and a nod. "Now," General Wei went on, "why don't you get a few hours of sleep while we maintain the watch?"
"Good idea, Wei."
Luo took 2 steps to the couch and lay down across it.
Wei opened the door, turned off the lights, then he closed the door behind himself. The communication center was only a few more steps. "Now," he said, stealing a smoke from a major, "what the hell is happening out there?" "If you want an opinion," a colonel of intelligence said, "I think the Americans just flexed their muscles, and the Russians will do so in a few hours."
"What? Why do you say that? And why the Russians?"
"Where has their Air Force been? Where have their attack helicopters been?"
"We don't know, do we?"
"Why don't we know?"
"Because the Americans have swatted our airplanes out of the sky like flies, that's why."
"We've deluded ourselves that the Russians don't want to fight, haven't we? A man named Hitler once thought the same thing. He died a few years later, the history books say. We similarly deluded ourselves into thinking the Americans would not strike us hard for political reasons. Way, some of our political leaders have been off chasing the dragon."
The aphorism referred to opium smoking, a popular, if illegal, pastime in the southern part of China a few centuries before.
"There were no political considerations. They were merely building up their forces, which takes time. And the Russians didn't fight us because they wanted us to get to the end of the logistical string. And then the fucking Americans cut that string off at Harbin and Bayan. General Peng's tanks are nearly 300 kilometers inside Russia now, with only 200 kilometers of fuel in their tanks, and there will be no more fuel coming up to them. We've taken over 2,000 tanks and turned their crews into badly trained light infantry. That is what's happening, Comrade Wei," the colonel concluded.
"You can say that sort of thing to me, Colonel. Say it before Minister Luo, and your wife will pay the state for the bullet day after tomorrow," Wei warned.
"Well, I know it," Colonel Geng Heiping replied. "What will happen to you later today, Comrade General Wei, when you organize the information and find out that I am correct?"
"The remainder of today will have to take care of itself," was the fatalistic reply.
"One thing at a time, gang."
Then he assembled a team of officers and gave them each a task to perform, found himself a chair to sit in, and wondered if Geng might have a good feel for the situation.
"Colonel Geng?"
"Yes, Comrade General."
"What do you know of the Americans?"
"I was in our embassy in Washington until 18 months ago. While there, I studied their military quite closely."
"And are they capable of what you just said?"
"Comrade General, for the answer to that question, I suggest you consult the Iranians and the Iraqis. I'm wondering what they might try next, but thinking exactly like an American is a skill I have never mastered."
"They're moving," Major Tucker reported with a stretch and a yawn. "Their reconnaissance element just started rolling. Your people have pulled way back. How come?"
"I ordered them to collect Comrade Gogol before the Chinese kill him," Colonel Tolkanov told the American.
"You look tired."
"Hell, what's 36 hours in the same chair?"
"A hell of a sore back, that's what it is," Tucker didn't say.
Despite the hours, he was having the time of his life. For an Air Force officer who'd flunked out of pilot training, making him forever an unrated weenie in Air Force parlance, a fourth-class citizen in the Air Force pecking order, below even helicopter pilots, he was earning his keep more and better than he'd ever done. He'd probably been more valuable to his side in this war than even that Colonel Winters, with all his air-to-air snuffs. But if anyone ever said such a thing to him, he'd have to "aw shucks it" and look humbly down at his shoes.
Humble my ass, Tucker thought. He was proving the value of a new and untested asset, and doing so like the Red Baron in his Red Fokker trimotor. The Air Force was not a service whose members cultivated humility, but his lack of pilot's wings had compelled him to do just that for all 10 of his years of uniformed service. The next generation of UAVs would have weapons attached, and maybe even be able to go air-to-air. And then, maybe, he'd show those strutting fighter jock itches who had the real balls in this man's Air Force. Until then, he'd just have to be content gathering information that helped the Russians kill Joe Chink and all his brothers. And if this was Nintendo war,
then little Danny Tucker was the by-God cock of the by-God walk in this virtual world.
You have been most valuable to us, Major Tucker.
Thank you, sir. Glad to help, Tucker replied with his best little boy smile. Maybe I'll grow me a good mustache. He set the thought aside with a smile and sipped some instant coffee from an MRE pack. The extra caffeine was about the only thing keeping him up at the moment. But the computer was doing most of the work, and it showed the Chinese reconnaissance tracks moving north.
Son of a bitch, Captain Alexandrov breathed.
He'd heard about Gogol's wolf pelts on state radio, but he hadn't seen the TV coverage, and the sight took his breath away. Touching one, he halfway expected it to be cold and stiff like wire. But no, it was like the perfect hair of a perfect blonde.
And who might you be?
The old man was holding a rifle and had a decidedly gimlet eye.
I am Captain Fedor Ilyich Alexandrov, and I imagine you are Pavel Petrovich Gogol.
A nod and a smile.
You like my furs, comrade captain? They are unlike anything I have ever seen. We have to take these with us.
Take?
Take where?
I'm not going anywhere, Pasha said.
Comrade Gogol, I have my orders. To get you away from here. Those orders come from headquarters, Far East Command, and those orders will be obeyed, Pavel Petrovich.
No chink is going to chase me off my land,
his old voice thundered.
No, Comrade Gogol, but soldiers of the Russian army will not leave you here to die.
So, that is the rifle you killed Germans with?
Yes. Many, many Germans, Gogol confirmed.
Then come with us and maybe you can kill some yellow invaders.
Who exactly are you?
Reconnaissance Company Commander, 265 Motor Rifle Division. We've been playing hide-and-seek with the Chinks for 4 long days, and now we are ready to do some real fighting. Join us, Pavel Petrovich. You can probably teach us a few things we need to know.
The young, handsome captain spoke in his most reasonable and respectful tones, for this old warrior truly deserved it. The tone turned the trick.
You promise me I will get to take one shot?
My word as a Russian officer, comrade, Alexandrov pledged, with a bob of his head.
Then I come.
Gogol was already dressed for it. The heat in his cabin was turned off. He shouldered his old rifle and an ammunition pack containing 40 rounds. He'd never gone into the field with more than that, and walked to the door.
Help me with my wolves, boy, will you?
Gladly, grandfather.
Then Alexandrov found out how heavy they were. But he and Buikov managed to toss them inside their BRM, and the driver headed off.
Where are they?
About 10 kilometers back. We've been in visual contact with them for days, but they've pulled us back. Away from them.
Why?
To save you, you old fool, Buikov observed with a laugh.
And to save these pelts. These are too good to drape over the body of some Chinese strumpet.
I think, Pasha, I am not sure, the captain said, but I think it's time for our Chinese guests to get a proper Russian welcome.
Captain, look, the driver called.
Alexandrov lifted his head out the big top hatch and looked forward. A senior officer was waving to him to come forward more quickly. 3 minutes later, they halted alongside him.
You are Alexandrov?
Yes, Comrade General, the young man confirmed to the senior officer.
I am General Sinyavsky. You've done well, boy. Come out here and talk to me,
he ordered in a gruff voice that was not, however, unkind. Alexandrov had only once seen his senior commander, and then only at a distance.